As I mentioned earlier, the tonight's Dharma talk is called How One Discovers Truth. And that's a quote out of a particular sutta I've been studying called the Kanki Sutta. And Kanki is just the name of some guy. And a lot of the suttas are have a main character who's involved with the Buddha in some way. And then they name the sutta after him. And I want to just mention a little bit about suttas in general and how often they are written. A lot of what the Buddha had to deal with in his time, 2,500 years ago, was the culture that he was living in at the time, the Brahmanic culture, objecting, sometimes quite strenuously. I mean, people tried to kill him at one point, but objecting quite strenuously to what he was doing. He was unorthodox. He, among other things, allowed women to join the Sangha, which was quite scandalous in those days. But more to the point, the Brahmins, who were the priestly caste, who basically were the ones in charge of the whole thing, and were the only ones officially allowed to teach and to, chant the Vedas and do all the ceremonies and all that sort of stuff, they felt that he was like competing with them too much, taking away the good students who were all going to study with the Buddha instead of hanging out with them like they should. And so a lot of the suttas have to do with a Brahmin or a group of Brahmins going to the Buddha, complaining, or arguing, or debating with him. And the pattern in all of these is quite interesting. This is one of those suttas, is that in the end, what happens is the Brahmins go, I think there's one case I can remember where this doesn't happen. Almost all the cases, the Brahmins in the end go, oh my God, this guy really knows what's going on, and he wins. The thing about those days, however, is if you were debating, having that sort of philosophical debate with another, between you and someone else, and they won, you had to become their student. This is high stakes debating, basically. So at the end of most of these suttas, there's someone declaring, I go to the Buddha, I take refuge in the Buddha as my teacher. They sort of, okay, I give up, essentially, which happens at the end of the sutta as well. I'll explain that quickly and then I'll get on to the talk. Basically, the sutta is a collection of the teachings of the Buddha. So these are actual, this was originally an oral tradition. So for the first 200 years of Buddhism as such, after the Buddha passed, all of the teachings of the Buddha had been memorized by the Sangha, by the monks and nuns. And their job, one of their jobs, was to pass that teaching on to a younger person. And then eventually this king, who was at that point the king of all of North India, which is a huge area in those days, became a very devout Buddhist and said, wait a second, we got to get all these guys together, all these men and women together who have hearts of this sutta, and write it all down. And then he got a bunch of scribes and he invited everybody to come and they wrote it all down. But these are all very direct teachings of the Buddha. And all of every sutta begins with the following phrase, thus have I heard. In other words, I wasn't there, but this is what I was told and now I'm repeating it for everybody else to hear. So in this particular sutta, Kanki is a very wealthy prominent Brahmin. He's been appointed by the king to rule over and run a big section of the country. And he's sort of sitting in his palace and looking out the window, and he sees a bunch of his fellow Brahmins walking along together very purposefully, and he says, "Hey, you know, where are you guys going?" And they say, "Oh, you know, the Gautama, the Buddha's in town, and we're going to go sit with him, talk to him." And Kanki says, "Oh, well, wait for me. I'm going to come too." So Kanki goes out, and the other Brahmins are like scandalized that Kanki would actually do this. And they were saying, "No, no, no. You're like the big Brahmin here. And this guy's just some recluse wandering monk guy. What are you doing going to see him? He should come and see you." And Kanki won't have, he just says, "No, no, 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 no. That isn't true. The Buddha, Gautama the Buddha, is accomplished and fully enlightened. I should go see him." So this is an exceptional Brahmin in the sutta. Most Brahmins are very disputatious. They want to have a big argument. And Kanki says, "No, no, 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 no. I should go see him. He's the accomplished one. I'm just, you know, the local potentate," right? So off they go to see the Buddha. And when they get there, in the sutta it says the Buddha is having some amiable talk with some very senior Brahmins. But there's also this young guy, a 16-year-old Brahmin named Kapatika, who is sort of trying to get in there and interrupt, and they're sort of shooing him away, like, "No, don't bother us, you young punk," basically, you know. And Kanki, once again, intervenes. He says, "No, no, no. This Kapatika is actually a very well-versed student who should be allowed to discourse with the Buddha." And so the Buddha acknowledges Kapatika, and they have this dialogue. And the dialogue is the actual, the dialogue is about how one discovers truth. So this young guy starts out, typical young guy, right? Kind of argumentative, troublemaker way. And he says, "Based on faith in their tradition, we have come to the conclusion only this is true. Anything else is wrong." "What do you think of that?" he says to the Buddha, essentially. "Only this is true. Anything else is wrong." Just like, we Brahmins know how things are. You know. This is, and the Buddha responds to this by asking Kapatika several questions. First question is there any Brahmin that you know who says this, "I know this, I see this, only this is true"? In other words, does someone you know actually know, with a capital K, this? Or is this just something you say traditionally? And Kapatika, being an honest guy, says, "Actually, no, I don't know anyone who actually knows this as true knowledge, as the truth. It's just tradition." And then the Buddha says, "Is there any teacher or teacher's teacher going back 7 generations, so way back, that you know who knows this to really be true?" And once again, Kapatika goes, "Well, no." Then the Buddha says, "Well, do any of the ancient teachers, the composers of the Vedas are the teachings that the Brahmins chanted and taught, do any of them say, 'I know this to be true'?" And once again, Kapatika goes, "No, not really." And then the Buddha then uses an interesting metaphor. Suppose there's a file of blind men, each in touch with the next. The first one does not see, the middle one does not see, and the last one does not see. So too, in regard to their statement, the Brahmins seem to be like a file of blind men. The first one does not see, the middle one does not see, the last one does not see. What do you think? That being so, does not faith of the Brahmins turn out to be groundless? And, of course, Kalpatika goes, yes, but. He doesn't want to give up quite yet. Yes, but, he says. Yes, Master Gautama, but they also honor this as an oral tradition. It was passed on orally, which means it's important, right? But it says, nah, that's not good enough, I'm sorry. In fact, he says, for something to be considered as something that preserves the truth, and the word preserved is used quite precisely, in other words, something that has maintained the truth for a long period of time, something that preserves the truth, you need, there are five things. What five? Faith, approval, oral tradition, reasoned cogitation, and reflective acceptance of a view. This is a list. Well, Buddhism is full of lists, right? Because this is an oral tradition, by the way, that's why there's so many lists, because it made it easier to remember. Right? So this is an interesting thing. So the Buddha is saying to preserve the truth, there's these five things that you can depend on. Faith, which is the first argument that Kapadika gave. Approval. And approval here means you think, and I think that's okay. It sort of makes sense to me. You know, it's like a sort of a casual think. You think about it enough that, yeah, that makes sense. Oral tradition. Well, think about pretty much every religious and philosophical school that there is are all very strongly based on oral tradition. But then we get to reasoned cogitation. This means you thought about it seriously. This isn't like a casual, yeah, I think that's okay. This is like, I really thought about this. And I thought about it a lot. And I listened to what other people had to say about it. And it sort of, yeah, this makes sense. I can see that. And then the last one was reflective acceptance. This means basically that you've gone beyond just thinking about it and you have some sort of intuitive grasp of it, that it seems at some deeper level than just mentally, logically, that there's some truth here. So these are the five ways that truth can be preserved. And sure enough, I'm okay with that, says Kapatika. But then the Buddha says, but, yes, but, he says, unfortunately, all of these things could be totally false. Based on faith or approval or oral tradition, any of these things, you could be leaving to something that's total nonsense. See that a lot in the world today, right? And so the Buddha says, though these might preserve the truth, this is how we maintain the truths that are being passed on to us, this isn't enough. You have to do more than that. You have to discover truth, which is and so then poor Kapatika says, yeah, okay, so, but in what way, Master Gotama, is there the discovery of truth? In what way does one discover truth? And the Buddha gives a very succinct and lengthy answer, which is the rest of the sutta, actually. And the first thing he says is, well, the first thing is to look at who's actually saying these things. Look at the teacher. Where this teaching is, who's expounding this truth, so to speak, and examine them to see if they are tainted by any of the three poisons. Greed, hatred, delusion. And the Buddha goes into great detail explaining what those three are. But basically he's saying, look at the source, look at the person, the teacher, this person who's teaching. Are they tainted? Is this teaching coming from someone who isn't clear about living a proper life? Are they caught by greed, hatred, or delusion? That's the first thing you have to do. It's not so much the teaching. Look at the teacher. Look where these teachings are coming from. And if this person is not tainted by the three poisons, now you should start to pay actual attention to them. But it's a very precise way you should do so. When he has investigated him and seen that he is purified from these states, then he places faith in him. Filled with faith, he visits him and pays respects to him. Having paid respect to him, he gives ear. When he gives ear, he hears the Dhamma. Having heard the Dhamma, he memorizes it and examines the meaning of the teachings he has memorized. When he examines their meaning, he gains a reflective acceptance of the teachings. When he has gained a reflective acceptance of those teachings, zeal springs up. When zeal has sprung up, he applies his will. Having applied his will, he scrutinizes. Having scrutinizes, he strives. Resolutely striving, he realizes with the body the supreme truth and sees it by penetrating it with wisdom. It's a long list. And then, of course, Kapatika is not finished asking questions yet. He says, yes, but so you've sort of come to this penetrating wisdom. You had a deep realization, in other words. But how can you be sure you've actually discovered the truth? The final arrival at truth lies in the repetition, development, and cultivation of those same things. In other words, practice, practice, practice. It all comes down to practice. Once you've had that insight, now you have to practice to make that insight more, take it deeper and deeper and deeper. So let's look at this list. I think this is a great list. So the first thing is you've found this teacher / teaching that comes from a pure source. Then you place your faith in that teaching. Faith. Very beginning. Faith comes first. You have to have faith. This is something you want to, because faith inspires you to do something. And then you visit and pay respects. In other words, you go to a teacher and you do so respectfully. You don't go there sort of planning to have a big argument or to sort of, you know, poo-poo what they're saying. You go there with respect. You're consciously choosing to be there to see if you can learn something. So it's an attitude you have to take when you go to hear teachings. Then you listen because the Dhamma is being taught. And remember, this being an oral tradition, that's the only way. You couldn't have, there was no books. The only way you learned the Dhamma in the Buddha's day was to go and listen. And then you hear the Dhamma. So, just listening and hearing, what's the difference? Here's the difference. We can go and listen. But we go and listen, and you know what happens? We're listening to someone say something, and all the way through we're sort of figuring out how we can say, well, no, it's all about this, and what about that. Or we're thinking, gee, I wonder what's going on with the Democratic debate on TV. You know, we're listening with half our mind, and the other half of our mind is like someplace else. So you not just listen, you actually have to hear the Dhamma. Like really take it in. Be serious about listening. And then the next one, this is interesting, because the next thing is memorizing. Memorize the teachings. Really don't just sort of, you know, read some interesting book and then put it down. This is a good way to start. Might give you a little faith. But you actually have to memorize the teachings. Really get to know them really deeply. And remember what I said, in the Buddhist time, that was a really important way how the Buddhist teachings were carried on, that certain students actually memorized, that was their duty to memorize the teachings so they could pass them on to the next generation. In our day, well, this is all written down and you can get it on YouTube and who knows what else, where else you can find it. Lots of places. But it's still, what I think they're emphasizing, what I want to emphasize here is you have to really go through this until it's like, oh yeah, I know all those lists in my head now. I know I've sort of dug in deeper and sort of absorbed these teachings at some much deeper mental level. And then we can examine the meaning. By the way, in many traditional cultures where there are teachings, the students are always told they should memorize the teachings first before the teacher will even explain them to them. This is true in the Vedic culture and in various other cultures, Brahmanic cultures. You know, people who are studying to be Brahmins to this day learn to chant the Veda before the teacher will explain to them what it means. You have to be able to chant it perfectly first. I remember when I was in India going to school for young boys. These are young boys like 6 to 12. And all they did all day long was chant. Beautifully, by the way. I mean, we went and just listened to them chant, and it was like, because that was their whole discipline, as they learned. And then once they could chant perfectly, then they were taught, start to taught the actual meanings as they got older. But they started just by learning to chant the teachings. Highly recommended, by the way. Little note here, I live with a Sanskrit teacher, which is how she teaches. She teaches by chanting and getting people to memorize the sutta. So anyhow, it's a minor detail. Then, once we've examined, now we are actually examining the meaning, we're actually looking at, what does this, now that I know the actual words, what did they mean? What does this mean? How does this fit together? You know, so this is sort of a deeper study than just memorizing. It's like actually maybe reading commentaries, listening to what different people say about it, reading different books about the same topic. You know, that's how we do it in our culture. Study. Really study. Then, reflective acceptance arises. This is the point where we're starting to have insights into the meanings. Like we're going, oh, you know, you have those little the little light comes on, you go, oh, that's what that was all about. And we those insights arise out of practice, out of actual meditative practice, where you've studied the Dhamma, you've studied the teachings, and now there you are sitting and something arises in your practice and you go, oh, because you've studied, you have the context to understand what's arising. And it sort of fits together and you have this intuitive, non-intellectual understanding as opposed to the purely intellectual understanding of study. But study leads to those moments of insight. Notice that at this point, with faith, visiting, listening, hearing, memorizing, examining, we've taken care of the first five that I listed earlier. We've taken care of faith, approval, oral tradition, reason, cogitation, and reflective acceptance. So now we've preserved the teachings. But we're only halfway through the list. We want to actually, we're talking about how to discover the truth, to know it at some much deeper level. What comes next? Zeal. Very old-fashioned word, zeal, isn't it? Something you hear a lot about. Zeal is like excitement. Like, oh, this is so interesting. This is like, I can't get enough of this stuff. It's like, I just want to dig deeper and deeper. I'm really not just sort of vaguely checking it out, you know, once a day, once a week on Sunday. I'm very zealous. There's another word you see sometimes talking about this same sort of attitude I'm talking about. It's called pitti, which is often translated as rapture. I don't like that particular word, rapture, because that has sort of connotations of losing control. I like, it's more like really intense, pleasurable interest. That's where we have to go, it's just, I love this stuff. I'm really interested in this stuff. Well, that's what zeal means. Zeal has to arise, because that's what motivates you to keep going. And then, after zeal comes will. In other words, you have to, I'm actually going to understand this. I'm going to do this. This is a fixed determination. This is right intention. This is also right effort. Two of the steps on the Eightfold Path, right? It's like I'm consciously forming this strong intention to really do it now. Will. It's not something I can casually sort of hope something happens. I have to consciously make it happen. I have to apply will. Then we come to that strange word scrutinizes in that list. And when I first read this list, I went, scrutinizes? What the heck does that mean? And I actually had to go into the footnotes and actually some other references to find it. And scrutinizing in this tradition means basically gaining deeper insight beyond the surface insight that you got at the point of reflective acceptance. This is insights not into the sort of surface meaning, but into what's really going on. Yeah. If we talk about this practice as being a way to really understand what life is all about, in a sense. So this is insights into impermanence, insights into not self, insights into things always changing. You have to sort of go underneath the surface of the teaching to this more profound part of the teaching. And this isn't easy. I'm not suggesting for one second it's easy. But that's, you keep going deeper into the teachings. This rises partly out of very deep concentrated states of mind, long, intense practice. And then, even now you're scrutinizing, you're having these understandings at a deeper level, then striving. Now, striving has a bad connotation sometimes in these teachings, because striving is like trying too hard. And if you strive too much, you sort of get really tight. That's not what it means here. It means just like, I'm going to keep going. 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 And then penetrating wisdom arises. Penetrating wisdom is another one of those code words in the teaching. Penetrating wisdom, when you've actually reached the stage of penetrating wisdom, this is sometimes called stream entry. Stream entry means, lucky you, only 5 lives left. In another 5 lives, you'll really have it. Whew, only 5 more. But it's a traditional teaching. No, I'm not speaking from experience here. I'm just teaching from what the teachings say. And then there are sort of layers past stream entry that we won't even get into. But it's like that when it says, when you have penetrated wisdom, you've penetrated right to the core. You've had a moment of true enlightenment. That's the moment when stream entry occurs. But then the Buddha says, well, that's a good start. Now, practice, practice, practice. Now, as I read in this line here, he said, the final arrival at truth lies in the repetition, development, and cultivation of these same things. So in other words, once you've had that moment of deep, penetrating wisdom, now you're starting at the next, you just come to the next level and now you've got more work to do. And that's just more practice and more practice and more practice and more practice. Until final enlightenment arises, whatever that means. And at this point, the young Brahmin says, oh, okay, I get it. Now I understand how to discover truth. And he, after asking a bunch more questions, surrenders to the Buddha and becomes his disciple. Much to the upset of some of the other Brahmins, by the way. He's this brilliant young student who was with Brahmin, and now he's become one of the Buddha's disciples. Which, okay. The interesting thing here, this is like, if you look at what this is saying, you've got to do this all yourself. There's no one can do this for you. There's no magic way. There's no blessing or anything. This is something you can only reach through your own practice. It's all up to you. No shortcuts, no special dispensation, no extra blessing. You just need to actually do it yourself. And the Buddha's laying this very precise step by step how that happens. The interesting thing for me here is that a lot of this starts back in the earlier steps with study. Study is a regular part of my practice, partly because of things like I read things like, oh, I actually should study this stuff. And I think within this tradition, it's something we forget sometimes, that we really need to actually study what the Buddha said and really go deep into it, because that allows us to start really having moments of reflective acceptance and with zeal going deeper and deeper into the practice. And so study, I think, is an extremely important part of this practice. Now, having said that, I don't want to like berate you all, because all of you are here right now, and what you're doing here right now is studying. Part of studying is coming and hearing the Dhamma. not listening, but actually hearing the Dhamma. This is a part of the study. That's why this Tuesday night Sangha and coming on a regular basis to Tuesday night Sangha is so important, because that allows you to really study, to really absorb the teachings in this particular way. So all I'm encouraging you to do is, like everything else, do more. But the fact that you're here means you're doing a lot more than most people. Right? Good for you. Excellent, as a matter of fact. Keep it up. Dig deeper. Of course, I have to say this with poetry as well. This is a poem by Mary Oliver. Called Mysteries, yes. And this talks to a certain extent of what I've been talking about up till now and the context I was talking about. Truly, we live with mysteries too marvelous to be understood. How grass can be nourishing in the mouths of the lambs. How rivers and stones are forever in allegiance with gravity, while we ourselves dream of rising. How two hands touch and the bonds will never be broken. How people come from delight or the scars of damage to the comfort of a poem. Let me keep my distance always from those who think they have the answers. Let me keep company always with those who say, look, and laugh in astonishment and bow their heads. Right attitude. So there's a couple of interesting things about the sutta I want to point out about what I've been saying up until now. I already mentioned a little bit. And that's that this whole thing started once you've gone to a particular teaching / teacher / tradition. It starts with faith. Faith is the beginning of this practice. And we actually acknowledge that every time we come here. You know, we chant the three refuges, right? The first refuge is taking refuge in the Buddha. What does that mean? What does it mean, take refuge in the Buddha? I mean, we can't actually take refuge in the physical Buddha. He lived 2,500 years ago, right? For me, it means two things. One is I have faith that the Buddha actually existed and actually achieved enlightenment and then taught for 40 years. I can't know that. I can only have faith that that's true. But even more important for me is something the Buddha said over and over and over again. He says, I'm not the only one who can do this. Everyone can do what I've achieved. We all have Buddha nature. We all have bodhicitta. It's inherent in us. And that I have to take on faith, because I certainly don't feel that way a lot of the time. I'm sort of like get caught up in other stuff. I feel anything less than full of bodhicitta. But I have to have the faith that I have that potential in me. So taking refuge in the Buddha is an act of pure faith. Then, after that, the whole next section in this talk was about the Dhamma and studying the Dhamma and learning the Dhamma. This is what taking refuge in the Dhamma means. We take refuge in the Buddha, then we take refuge in the Dhamma. And to take refuge in the Dhamma is not just to like, oh, isn't that a nice that he wrote this, this all got written down. This is what I was just saying, talking about study. This is where we actually have to dig deep into these teachings. And to take refuge in the Dhamma is to actually pay attention to these teachings and study them and learn them and know more about them. That's how we take refuge in the Dhamma. There is no other way. not just sort of casually, oh, isn't that great stuff that they talk about every Tuesday night. So that's a good start, as I said. But to go deeper, to study, to learn more. And then the third thing we take refuge in is the Sangha. That's us, right here, right now. This is something we all take refuge in every time we come here. We take refuge in the fact that there are other people of like mind and heart who want to have faith in the Buddha and to study and to absorb the teachings. And that encourages us. And the beauty of Sangha is it's a way that we get encouraged to keep going, to come. You know, I'm sure you all, as I have some, like you come here and you go, oh God, I'm not sure if I want to be here. I don't know why I'm here. I wish I was like home, you know, watching YouTube or something. Whatever you want. However you entertain yourself, right? And then as you're here and you're sitting and you notice all these other people sitting and you feel the energy in this room of this practice community practicing together, you just get perked up. It's like it brings you into connection. That's the beauty of Sangha. You know, one of my favorite suttas is a place where Ananda, who was the Buddha's attendant for many, many years, comes to the Buddha and says, is it true that half of this teaching is, you know, good companionship, good fellowship, you know, Sangha, right? And the Buddha goes, no, Ananda. All of this teaching is good fellowship, good companionship. Without Sangha, I mean, I suppose you could sort of go off and live in a cave by yourself for 20 years and figure this out. But it's the rare person who does that. Most of us need Sangha. We need that community. So we have this interesting set of three things. When we take refuge in the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha, we're taking refuge in faith, knowledge, love. It's like the three-legged stool that supports this entire practice. Faith, knowledge, love. That's how this stuff works. That's why this is so important. Just being here together. Because we need that too. And I know it encourages me every time I come here to keep coming here and doing more and studying more and digging in, preparing talks and doing all that stuff I do. I'm not quite finished yet. Because there's one thing about this sutta that I had to think a lot about, because remember at the very beginning, before we got to that long list, you know, the Buddha said, first of all, the teacher, this person who's teaching, has to be untainted, to have no taints, to be free from greed, hatred, and delusion. I'm not qualified. So now what do we do? And this is true for all of us. How do we look at this idea that the people sitting in this chair aren't perfect? How do we look at that? Because there's a very important thing we need to think about. Because there's lots of examples of people who were not only not perfect, they were downright scoundrels sitting in chairs like this. And we have to think about that. And I want to think about that and talk about this in two ways. One is, notice what the Buddha did. He said, look at these people and understand where they're coming from and how are they really suitable. So when we're thinking about absorbing teaching, sitting with the teachers, sitting with a group of teachers, whatever, going to a particular tradition, look deeply at where these people are coming from. and make sure that there's not ulterior motive there, which is, in our culture, has happened over and over and over again in the West in the last 50 years. This one teacher after another has been discovered to be a scoundrel, including, by the way, personally, I had a teacher who I later discovered was a total scoundrel. So I speak from personal experience here. But I discovered, and the thing that I came across, I was looking in the sutta, of course. And this is a sutta that's called Who's Qualified to Be a Speaker of the Dhamma? Bhikkhu. Buddha was talking to a particular person. If one teaches the Dhamma for the purpose of revulsion towards ignorance. Revulsion towards ignorance. For its fading away in sensation, one is fit to be called a bhikkhu who is a speaker of the Dhamma. I can sort of feel comfortable with that. You know, there's another place in the sutta where the Buddha goes through this list. I couldn't find the particular sutta that when I was getting this talk together, but I've seen it someplace. Home with the sutta is like a bookshelf this big, right? Where he says, basically, first of all, you should study with an enlightened being. Can't find an enlightened being right now? Well, then, study with a direct disciple of someone who's an enlightened being. Can't find that? Then find someone who studied with someone who, you know. And then at the end of that list, he said, if all you can do is find someone who knows perhaps more than you know and study with him. Once again, I feel vaguely qualified there. You know, I've been practicing for 40 years. I've been studying for a long time. I'm sort of, hopefully, a little bit qualified to sit here. But that's the only difference between me and you. I've been doing this a bit longer and maybe a bit more intensely. That's all. Nothing special at all. Just done it more. And that makes me feel comfortable in sitting here. Thinking in that way. But one more piece of poetry, once again from Mary Oliver. This is from a longer poem. This is the last section of a longer poem, which once again speaks to the attitude we take towards this whole practice. What I loved in the beginning, I think, was mostly myself. Never mind that I had to, since somebody had to. That was many years ago. Since then, I've gone out from my confinements, though with difficulty. I mean the ones that thought to rule my heart. I cast them out. I put them on the mush pile. They will be nourishment somehow. Everything is nourishment somehow or another. I have become the child of the clouds and of hope. I have become the friend of the enemy, whoever that is. I have become older, and cherishing what I have learned, I have become younger. And what do I risk to tell you this, which is all I know? Love yourself, then forget it. Then love the world. That's what all this is about, as far as I'm concerned. Nothing more than that.